The book is called Sextant, A Young Man's Daring Sea Voyage and the Men Who Mapped the World's Oceans. To talk about that is that young man, who's not as young anymore, but he'll tell us a little bit about that, is David Berry, who joins us, a practicing seaman and lifelong mariner who learned to navigate with a sextant. I'm only familiar with a sextant from a picture or maybe from an old nautical movie. Describe what a sextant is and what its purpose is to navigation.
Well, a sextant is simply a device for measuring angles very accurately indeed, and specifically the angle between the horizon and what we often call a heavenly body. So something like the sun, the moon, a planet, or a star. And it uses a small telescope and a couple of mirrors. And it is the key, or was the key, to accurate offshore navigation for about 200 years or so, until really the arrival of GPS.
When was it that you first started learning how to use one of these devices?
Well, I had this lucky break when I was a student. I was 19, and a retired British naval officer invited me to come and sail with him in his 35-foot sloop up in Maine and Nova Scotia, and then to sail back across the Atlantic to England. And it was on that voyage that I was introduced to the sextant, and Colin McMullen, that was his name, Colin taught me how to navigate with the sextant, and it was a really life-changing experience. I was completely blown away by it, and I've remained fascinated ever since. And I came to write the book, really, because it suddenly struck me a few years ago that what I call the golden age of celestial navigation, navigation using the sextant, had almost come to an end with the arrival of satellite navigation. And I wanted to pay tribute to Colin, my teacher, and also to the extraordinary people in the late 18th and early 19th century, the sort of pioneers of oceanography, if you like, the men like Cook and Bougainville and Vancouver and Flinders and Fitzroy, who set out across the world to make the very first accurate charts of the world's oceans using the sextant.
We're talking with Dave Berry. The book is called Sextant, A Young Man's Daring Sea Voyage and the Men Who Mapped the World's Oceans. What did they do prior to the development of the sextant? How were they able to even navigate? I guess the stars was the key to the whole thing, but tell me the process to the point where someone said, hey, I got an idea how we can use some sort of a device to help us.
People have been using the sun and the stars to help find their way, probably for tens of thousands of years, maybe hundreds of thousands of years. But it wasn't really until the late Middle Ages that people began to develop accurate instruments for measuring the heights of heavenly bodies, things like the astrolabe and the cross staff. And those were useful to find your latitude. They enabled you to work out how far north or south of the equator you were. But there was no way, until the longitude problem was solved in the middle of the 18th century, there was no way of working out how far east or west you'd gone. And that's why it wasn't possible to make accurate maps. And the longitude problem was solved in two completely different ways, almost simultaneously, in the 1750s. One was the development of the marine chronometer by William Harrison, John Harrison, who was this amazing watchmaker. And the other was a completely different method that involved measuring the angles between the sun and the moon. And that depended on having really accurate tables predicting the movements of the moon. And that was an incredibly difficult problem in mathematics and astronomy. But both of those methods were developed simultaneously, and both, interestingly, depended on the sextant, because you needed an instrument that would measure angles with great, great accuracy, and that was the sextant.
Many times we think of people who are out on the ocean, the seamen, there's a lot physical. But it seems to me there's a lot more mental ability, acuity that they needed to develop. I mean, they needed to sort of have a little bit more of a mathematician's mind than one might think when they head off onto the seas.
That was certainly true, and remained true, really, until very recently, because I think one of the sad things about GPS, it's a wonderful technology, but one of the sad things about it is that it doesn't make any demands of us. You simply press a button and you get the answer. Whereas hitherto, if you were the navigator, you had to understand quite a lot about astronomy and mathematics, and you needed to learn the skill, and it is a real skill, of using a sextant accurately. So you're right. Those early navigators and map makers were people of extraordinary abilities. I mean, they had to be very, very good seamen. They had to be good leaders. They had to be good at mathematics. They had to be good observers. They were remarkable individuals. And one of the purposes of my book is to pay tribute to their astonishing achievements, often in really difficult, dangerous, and exposed situations on the far side of the world.
Talk a little bit about your journey itself as a young man using the sextant to navigate the North Atlantic. What was that like? And, you know, what personal things did you gain out of that?
Well, it was a mixture of kind of sometimes being pretty scared, sometimes being pretty bored, sometimes being very cold and wet and uncomfortable, sometimes a real sense of exaltation, you know, seeing the whole brilliant night sky for the first time, far out of sight of land where there's no glow of man-made light. I mean, to see the night sky on the open ocean is a breathtaking spectacle. And the business of learning to navigate, I loved. Colin McMullen was a great teacher, and I loved that. And it was an odd roller coaster emotional experience, but a very profound one. And I suppose one of the things it left me with was a great admiration and respect for the early navigators who were heading off, you know, people like Cook and Bougainville and so forth, heading off into the unknown and taking terrific risks. And some of them, one of the people I mentioned in the book was a great French navigator called La Pérouse. Some of them never made it home. You know, he was lost in about 1789. And the remains of the two ships that he led weren't found for another 30 years.
How were you able to do the research for this? Is a lot of this documented? Did the people keep a lot of good journals? What was the source of resource?
Yes. No, one of the really exciting things about writing the book was spending time in the libraries and archives and actually handling the original logbooks and the letters in the handwriting of these great heroic people. It was a thrilling thing.
One of the things you kind of mentioned, or at least was in the news release here, related to the fact that sometimes they would find land or islands that they would never be able to locate again. It's like when I flip through a magazine or a book and you see a picture and you're thinking, where is that? And you keep flipping back forward and suddenly it's not there anymore. And you thought, I just saw it. How did it do it? So that I can imagine that happened quite a bit for many of these explorers.
It did. And actually one of the big, big problems they confronted was that often people would report that they'd seen land and give a rough location. And then these professional hydrographers, these professional chart makers, would have to go out and try and find them. And often as not, they weren't there, but it would take ages to determine for sure that a reported reef or tiny island in the middle of an ocean actually wasn't there. And some of these imaginary bits of land remained on charts until really quite recently. It's astonishing. Nobody ever wanted to say that something wasn't there in case it actually was. So they had to look very, very hard, and it was exhausting and time consuming.
We're talking today with David Barry. The book is Sextant, A Young Man's Daring Sea Voyage and the Men Who Mapped the World's Oceans. When you were documenting or researching these different explorers, these people that went out there, what was the common sense about them as people that drove them to do this sort of thing?
I think a lot of it was professional pride. They were the best navigators of their day, and they were very proud of their skills. I think there was a lot of honor associated with producing the first accurate charts of any newly discovered territory. So there was a degree of pride in that too. And I think also they were adventurers. They enjoyed being at the cutting edge, of science as well as anything else, because they all took botanists and zoologists and artists with them who would record everything that they saw. So the crews of these often very small ships that they were sailing in were a wonderful mixed bag. You know, you'd have rough, ordinary seamen, and you'd have very cultivated, eminent scientists, and you'd have the naval officers in between. So they were a strange kind of mobile community.
We do that same thing now when we travel to space. We seem to try to bring in different disciplines because we know that if you're only looking for one thing, you may just find that one thing. But being able to bring people who have a different perspective, or a artist, somebody who has a different idea, then you can obviously find more things, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think it's that there's a close resemblance between the two. I suppose the big difference was that before the invention of radio, there was no way they could keep in touch with home. So people would head off on voyages lasting 2, 3, or 4 years, knowing that there would be no contact with home until they got back. So it was fantastically lonely. And sometimes people cracked under the strain. There's one of the people I mentioned in the book, wonderful man called Pringle Stokes, who had the job in the 1820s of surveying the west coast of Tierra del Fuego, which is a fantastically rough and dangerous coast down at the southern tip of South America. And he just, it was so miserable and cold and dangerous that he cracked under the strain and shot himself. So they didn't all cope. It was very, very demanding work and dangerous. The commanding officers were under a terrific strain because they weren't just there to make charts. They also had to look after the welfare of their crews. They had to make sure the ships were in good order, and they had to find new supplies of food and fresh water and wood for cooking and all kinds of other duties. It was very, very intense.
Did you come across any explorers or people that were sort of looking at the same coin from two different sides and didn't realize that two people were sort of discovering the same thing?
Yes, that happened a lot. I mean, you know, the French and the British were rivals particularly, but the Spanish too in the Pacific. So Vancouver, when he was up exploring the coast of what we now call British Columbia, bumped into the Spanish, and he was a bit surprised. He thought he was going to have the place to himself, and he bumped into these Spanish sailors, but they had a friendly relationship and worked together. When Bougainville arrived in Tahiti, he realized that another European ship had just been there, and he couldn't quite work out what nationality it was, because of course the people of Tahiti couldn't really tell him. It was a British ship that had just called there a few months earlier. When Flinders was exploring the coast of Australia, he bumped into a French ship, also on a voyage of exploration. And actually there was a lot of sharing of information. I mean, one of the surprising things is that even during the Anglo-French wars, and there were a lot of them, the two scientific communities were sharing information all the time. And they recognized the importance of these voyages of exploration, and they gave passports to enemy ships that were engaged in voyages of discovery to make sure that they wouldn't be interfered with.
Was it a case of who discovered what first, as far as, was it a point where you discovered it, or by the time you got back to report it? So if you got something, was there kind of a race then back to the mainland, as it were, or someplace?
There was a bit of that about it, although I think they were mostly pretty kind of honorable men. And I think if they were convinced that somebody else had been there first and had accurately charted it, they would acknowledge that. It would have been, I think, regarded as kind of very kind of ungentlemanly behavior to make a claim to have discovered something that somebody else had already discovered. Though that did sometimes happen by accident.
Were they compensated in a way? In other words, how were they paid? How was it their livelihood? What was the situation there?
They were just paid their ordinary wages as professional naval officers, and that wasn't a lot of money. I mean, a British Royal Navy lieutenant in the 18th century was paid less than £100 a year, and that's what they were paid. They didn't get anything extra.
The book is called Sextant, A Young Man's Daring Sea Voyage and the Men Who Mapped the World's Oceans. Our guest today has been David Barry. Thanks for sharing the insight with us. We appreciate it, and the stories, and letting people know about maybe some of those unforgotten folks that are responsible for the map and the globe the way that we see it today.
Well, thanks very much for having me on the show. It's been fun.